Today on Pals and Paleo, we're chatting with Phoebe McInerney about the giant flightless bird, Jenny Ornis. This episode, we discuss the demon duck of doom, killer cassowary kicks, stomach stones, and paleopathologies, aka fossil injuries and diseases. Pals and Paleo presents Jenny Ornis with the soon-to-be doctor, Phoebe McInerney.
Let's go back.
This is Pals in Paleo, where we chat with experts in the field about their journeys, experiences, and the fascinating fossils they work on. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and wannabe birdwatcher Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show by following along on Instagram. Our handle is at Pals in Paleo, all one word, and paleo is spelled P-A-L-A-E-O. Pals and Paleo acknowledges the connection between country, fossils, and deep time. We pay our respects to country, as well as the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia, and recognise their interactions with the megafauna discussed in this episode, as well as their connection to land, sky, all waterways, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, especially the Eastern Kulin Nations, on whose land this episode was recorded, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This episode was recorded with the assistance of the Museums Victoria Conservation Department, and fossils of Jenny Ornis newtoni are known from several sites across Australia, including the traditional lands of the Gamilaroi and Uwalaroi people of the Gomoroi Nation in what's also known as Cuddy Spring, the lands of the Gunai Kurnai people whose custodianship includes Wellington Caves, the Buandik people as the traditional custodians of what's also known as Mount Gambier, the custodianship of the Garan Jiri Nation along the Coorong, which encompasses Salt Creek. We acknowledge the Gadjuri people as the traditional custodians of what is also known as Baldina Creek. Jenny Ornis fossils are known from Narracourt Caves located between the ancestral lands of the Potawatomi people to the north, the Jadwaljali people to the east, the Buandik people to the south, and the Meantung people to the west. Finally, fossils of Jenny Ornis were first recorded from the traditional lands of the Pilatapa people, whose custodianship includes Lake Calabona. We recognise that sovereignty was never ceded. This was, and always will be, Aboriginal land. On today's episode, I'm combining my newfound love of birdwatching with my passion for paleontology. That's right, we're finally talking about a fossil bird. Not a dinosaur, not something that technically fits within that group. No, proper actual birds. Although, if you're keen to hear me try and explain why birds are dinosaurs, a little while ago, I did a live podcast recording with my good mate, Cesar Pushmaran, for his podcast, Death by Birding. The episode we recorded live is now up online, and we had so much fun. The other guest on the show was comedian Peter James, and there is swearing in that episode, but if that doesn't bother you, definitely check that out. We talked about bird evolution, reasons why birds might have survived the end Cretaceous mass extinction, but other dinosaurs didn't, de-extinction of the dodo very briefly, and the Hwatzin, which we kind of reference in the title of the episode, but I'm not going to ruin the surprise. If you're keen to hear about all of that, listen to Death by Birding episode 18, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Before we get into my interview with Phoebe and talk about the giant flightless bird Jenny Ornis, the podcasting union will come down on me like a ton of bricks unless I bring you a random fossil fact. Just kidding. I'm sure at most I'll get a slap on the wrist. And they who violate this law shall be punished by catapult. Today's random fossil fact is that sauropod dinosaurs had avian-like respiratory infections. So I was reminded of this fact the day we recorded the Death by Birding live show. My good mate Caesar and I were hanging out, and he was lamenting about the fact that birds get respiratory infections just constantly. He's in his final year of vet school and also works at a wildlife vet hospital, so he has a lot of experience with sick animals and loves his birds, as you might have guessed, so he's very familiar with them as patients. Anyway, the reason why birds get respiratory infections so often compared to, say, us humans is because their body is set up differently to ours. Birds are super efficient at breathing, and part of the reason why is that they have pneumatic bones, which means air gets in their bones. Now, that has its advantages and helps them fly, breathe easily compared to us, but it also makes them super susceptible to getting infections. But it wasn't just birds that got infected either. Based on research published by Woodruff and colleagues in February 2022 in the journal Scientific Reports, long-necked dinosaurs from the Jurassic also came down with respiratory diseases. Now, just as a reminder, Sam mentioned in episode 13 on Diamantinosaurus that sauropods have pneumatic bones, and that makes them lighter and probably helped them get their ridiculously massive sizes. But the pneumatic bones present in both birds and long-necked dinosaurs means they are both prone to getting similar types of infections. Pneumatic bones, by the way, are bones which have lots of spaces in them that air gets into. As I've said before, it's basically bones doing their best impression of bubble wrap. Getting back to that paper written by Woodruff et al. From 2022, I mentioned earlier, the bones at the center of this study were neck vertebrae of something related to Diplodocus and were collected from the famous Morrison Formation of southwest Montana. The bones belong to a specimen nicknamed Dolly, and they have these weird and unusual growths that, according to lead author Carrie Woodruff, looked a bit like broccoli. Which is super strange because bones really don't have bubbly-like growths, and Carrie, having seen many sauropod bones before, knew straight away there was something strange, something out of the ordinary with these sauropod neck bones. So she took a photo of it and posted it to social media and quickly heard back from other scientists who had seen similar growths in living birds and other reptiles. Some of them ended up working together with Woodruff and writing a paper. By the way, the title of that one is The First Occurrence of an Avian-Style Respiratory Infection in a Non-Avian Dinosaur. And that paper is free to read because it's Scientific Reports, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out. But I wanted to circle back to and highlight the fact that this paper came out because she posted about this discovery to social media and reached out and get others involved. Together, this team described these unusual sauropod bones, and the most likely cause is a pneumonia-like ailment known as air sacculitis. Now, they couldn't pinpoint a cause, since this thing, air sacculitis, can be caused by viruses, by fungi or bacteria, but this sauropod was definitely suffering. When birds today have respiratory diseases, they have difficulty breathing, run a fever, cough, sneeze, and are just generally low on energy. They're lethargic. It's possible that this sauropod was struggling with these same symptoms too, and that it might have been the cause of death for this animal, but that's really difficult to say based on the evidence at hand. What we do know is that sauropods are more like birds than we could have ever imagined, and their bones record struggles with injuries and diseases. This is something that Phoebe also observed when working on the bones of Jenny Ornes. Let's now hear about other paleopathologies, other injuries and diseases recorded in the fossil record and the magnificent Mihirungs with Phoebe McInerney. This is Pals in Paleo, the podcast where we get to talk about the form, function, and family groupings of fossils and extinct animals. Today's special guest is Phoebe McInerney, all the way from Flinders University in South Australia.
Hi, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. Excited for the conference.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice to be able to see so many people in our field.
And we also bumped into each other a couple nights ago. We went and did an ecology walk at Mount Rothwell?
To see the native animals.
Yeah, it was cool seeing a bunch of little marsupials, potoroos.
There were so many.
Yeah.
It's wonderful work they do.
Really, yeah, fun. It was really wild to see eastern barred bandicoots, potoroos, quolls, which were in enclosures. Oh, and then the banjo frogs and the pobobonks were beautiful.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, the noise that they make.
Oh, I thought someone was playing music.
Yeah, because it's like with the two different frogs together.
It's so rhythmic, though.
Yeah.
It was like...
But yeah, you're at Flinders University and you've submitted your PhD.
Yeah, just.
But you haven't been conferred yet. It's still so you're in purgatory at the moment.
Yeah, it's in the review process. So don't stress about it. You can't do anything about it. It's fine.
It'll be what it'll be. And
yeah.
So we can't call you doctor yet.
Not yet.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it'll be soon, I reckon, because you've got 2 lead author papers on Jenny Ornes.
Yeah, and then 1 that's submitted and going to be published soon, and another 2 that are just about to be submitted.
Yeah, so soon, doctor, which is awesome. Before we dive into your work on Jenny Ornes, I normally love to start asking people, if they were paleo-obsessed kids and what their journey into paleo was like.
Yeah, well, mine was quite different because I didn't have that real paleo drive when I was younger. I definitely wasn't a dino kid. I didn't go to the museum all the time. I was actually a dancer, so I just spent all my time dancing. And then that got me into physiotherapy because I thought that would be a way to kind of keep myself within that space.
Yeah.
But I ended up realizing that I really loved the anatomy and physiology side of things, but I wasn't interested in physio as a career path. And I started, exploring nature a lot more, doing a lot more hikes. I went to Africa for a while and discovered the wonder of birds. And yeah, I really fell in love with that. So when I realized I could study bird anatomy, I just went for it as soon as I could. And that led me into paleo because that's really how you look at the anatomy and morphology of these animals.
Yeah, it tells you a lot about how they lived and what makes them unique and different as well. On the nature walk, I was really impressed and almost a little bit intimidated. You had a giant camera.
Yeah, well, I'm still not as good at using it as some of the wildlife photographers that you see, but I really like the idea of just being able to capture and record the birds that I see. So I have my own kind of list and photographic reference for the species that we see. So
yeah, no, that's definitely handy. I'm slowly getting into birding as well. I don't know whether it's because I've turned 30, but a really good friend of mine, Cesar Pushmaran, who also hosts a podcast called Death by Birding, he's kind of gotten me into it, but I don't photograph birds. Yeah. So it's interesting for me because I'll make a mental note of, okay, it has these patterns on the wings and the bill shape was like this and all these things. But then sometimes when I actually pull up a guide, I realize, oh, this is the things that I focused on aren't actually useful for distinguishing this type of honey eater or something like that. But
yeah.
I don't know. It's nice because it's a hobby that I'm really terrible at, so I can't monetize it at all. So that's nice to have something that's just walking and I get to share it with my dad as well.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's making me a better scientist and paleontologist because I'm trying to be more observation-led and really pay attention to what it actually looks like and is.
Yeah. Yeah. You really need to pull out all of those little things that you don't necessarily see immediately to ID birds because you'll have 5 honey eaters and let's be honest, they all look the same. But it also means that you start seeing the trees that they spend their time in or the grasses and the types of habitats and you learn more about the ecology just by, you start somewhere and it ends up being a lot broader than what you realize.
Yeah, everything's connected.
Yeah, I think it's good to not always be a photographer though because then you end up worrying about how good your photo is and you need to step back and just appreciate the bird for a bit. So
yeah, the composition. Yeah, depending on how flighty they are and stuff, it is wonderful when they just want to hang out. So did you also do field work in South Africa?
Yeah, yeah. So as part of my undergraduate degree, I went to Africa twice and spent just over 2 months there. And we were heading out to game reserves and wandering among the antelopes and the elephants and doing a lot of faunal surveys and floral surveys and things as well to look at environmental health and stuff like that. So
was that when you were with Flinders or?
Yeah, there was a teacher at Flinders who really wanted to add this into the Bachelor of Science and he constructed 2, a second and a third year program for it. So I was really lucky that I got to go on both because the year after the third year, he left Flinders. So it kind of fluctuated and I think it doesn't run anymore. So
yeah, it sounds like an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, a lot of money and work, I think so.
And then at that point, were you thinking of getting into paleontology, or how did you get sucked into this world?
I think I hadn't even thought about paleontology that much as a career path. I was just so focused on, like, I fell in love with birds after falling in love with anatomy, and I paired the two. I was just like, what is something that I can do where I can work within this sphere? And, you know, paleontology is that. We can look at specific groups in their morphology, and I can use fossils and look at extant taxa as well. So it allows me to get this really broad understanding of birds and what they're like, and get really underneath the skin and learn more about them. So,
yep. And yeah, your PhD was on Genyornis,
yeah,
which is a massive bird. Can you describe it to us and, like, paint us a word picture?
Oh, so I reckon it would have been pretty dopey looking. But you take a goose and you make it 250-ish kilos in size, 2 to 2.5 meters tall.
Pew! Hey, it's Adele. I just wanted to let you know that 250 kilograms is equal to 550 pounds, which is about as much as a vending machine weighs. So that's terrifying to think a bird got that heavy. And if Genyornis is 2 to 2.5 meters tall, that is equal to 6.5 to 8.2 feet tall. So a gigantic bird. Okay, back to Phoebe.
And you just have this massive, derpy looking goose. And it would have just wandered about pretty slowly and chewed on some light material, and that's about it for its life. So, yeah.
I think this is right. I think I've heard the nickname Demon Duck used for Genyornis, because Australians just love to do things like that.
Well, there was a time when somebody looked at the gastornithids, which are giant flightless birds from the Northern Hemisphere, and they have these really massive skulls.
Mm.
So people were thinking that because they're large, it means that they have all this power in their jaw, so therefore they must be carnivorous.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so somebody came along and was like, well, you know, dromanithids also have large jaws, so therefore we have a carnivorous bird.
But no.
Okay. It was a very, they called them killer birds and demon ducks of doom, and gave them all thunderbirds, all of these names.
Yeah.
And then the evidence was just not with that. And they were pretty clearly vegetarians.
Gentle giants.
Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't go on one's bad side, but.
No, I mean, like, even just your normal garden variety goose is terrifying when it wants to be. And they're totally different to terror birds.
Yeah. So the dromanithids are more closely related to your galloanserae, which is the ducks and geese and chickens and things like that. Yep. Whereas terror birds are much further down the avian tree.
Oh, okay. So I'm guessing in Australia, they lived during the time of the megafauna?
Yeah, so they actually have a really long temporal range. So we have...
So like a big, long fossil record of, like, really old to some younger ones.
Yeah. So we have a most likely dromanithid foot cast from the early Eocene.
Oh.
It's a Red Banks Plains formation in Queensland.
So that'd be like 40 or 30 million years?
I think it's like around 55.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. That is quite old.
Yeah, so really old. And then Genyornis is the youngest, and we have that at about 55,000 years. So we go from 55,000 to 55 million years for the dromanithids.
Wow.
But they probably diverged from their most closest ancestor, which is the anhemids in South America. They probably diverged from them, like, even earlier.
They would have, like, a Gondwanan connection there.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Because at the point that we see them 55 million years ago, they're already giant and flightless. So
yeah.
They're already dromanithids.
Yeah. Any fossil with, like, hollow bones as well, it's like your origin, I don't know.
Yeah.
You just are. You just appear.
Yep.
Big ghost lineage.
Yeah. There must be some small flighted bird that was in Australia around 60-ish million years ago that then all of a sudden became giant and flightless. And I very much doubt you'd ever be able to correlate that unless you found an anhemid at that time. But who knows? So,
well, you keep digging. Maybe we'll
find
it. But, yeah, it's so hard because fossils are rare anyway. Yeah. And then, fossils of birds are pretty rare.
And I mean, Australia would have all of the fossil sites, I reckon, just somewhere, but it's such a large country that actually finding them and sampling them well enough would be so difficult. So,
yeah, watch this space. Maybe in future work, I don't know. And then being such, I guess, big animals as well, is the skeleton like pretty well known, or is it mainly like skulls, for example?
So skull material is pretty rare.
Okay.
Especially for genuineness. The postcranial material we get heaps of.
Okay.
So they were discovered at Lake Calabona in the late 1800s.
Is that in South Australia?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's in the Lake Eyre region.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, yeah.
Quite northern South Australia above the Flinders Ranges. And we have entire individuals. So you walk out there and you just see the skeleton of a bird and...
Like it just laid down and died.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And it's just stayed there. The legs are all articulated. You get the sternum and the pelvis all articulated and the wings. And yeah, unfortunately, because the way they died is they got stuck in mud.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So their heads would be on a higher level, and as it erodes, the heads would go first.
Yeah, okay.
And then the bodies.
Oh, so they're getting bogged, but they're standing upright.
Well, we do have, it's an interesting story because we have some individuals that have obviously been walking along and their feet get stuck.
Yeah.
And the erosion's cut off the rest of the bird. So we just see these legs going straight down into the mud.
Mm-hmm.
But then we might have a bird next to it, which has just curled up and died. And it's just lying on the surface. And we can't really see why it's died. It's just next to one that got stuck.
It might have been sick because I help run a sheep and cattle station as well. Sometimes you'll get a sheep that's bogged out of the mud and it's properly stuck. Its wool's wet, which has made it heavier, and it can't pull its legs out. But then next to it, there might be one that's just a little sick, kind of crook, and it's not really that stuck, but it's just kind of hunched up and sickly. And
yeah, and we think that they were probably in like small family groups too, so they might not have wanted to leave each other.
Yeah.
Because like it wouldn't have been a nice situation to die of starvation in the mud. So.
And then I guess it's hard to work out what their family structure would have been like, but there are some birds that mate for life. There are some birds that just mate for a season and stuff, but sometimes they can be pretty loyal and hang around. And
so with other dromanithids, it's a bit hard to tell because all of their bones are just like random disassociated elements.
Yeah.
But with Genyornis, across Lake Calabona, we'll have groups of birds. We might have two birds together in one area, and a bit further down the like stream bit, you'll have three birds together, and a bit further along you'll have another two birds or something. So we're seeing this really regular pattern of birds grouping together, which does indicate to us that we are seeing these small family groups. But whether that's...
So no signs of chicks with them? Or?
No, interestingly not. Yeah.
I'm just picturing it now because, it's always really cool when you're driving around the outback and you see Emu Dad with his chicks and stuff. And
yeah, but I don't know if they were just too light to be stuck in the mud. But, yeah, we don't find them. There is a bit of a argument with some eggshell for Genyornis. So I'm really hoping that one day we'll find a Genyornis with an egg in it.
Yeah. Wayne. Indisputable, can't argue with that.
Yeah, like we have pouch young and gut contents for other animals at Calabona, but we don't have anything for Genyornis. So one day we might find one.
Those eggs would be massive, you'd have to assume as well.
Yeah, pretty big, but it's hard to tell. Like they have this really long pelvis, so it's a bit more slender than what you'd assume for the bird. So they have these massive bulky legs, but the pelvis itself is long and a bit thinner, so... It definitely would have been about the size of an emu egg, if not a little bit bigger.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Also, emu eggs are just like that gorgeous green colour, so it's nice to think like, oh, is it going to be like a brown to blend in, or is it going to be that beautiful rich green?
Yeah.
I don't think I've asked about the wings because, again, like my frame of reference is something living like an emu, because emus, you can see their wings if you look for them and they kind of look weird.
Yeah.
They look...
Just see them hanging out of the body.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. So
what are the wings on a genyornis like?
Well, we've had a student working on this just over the past year, and she's done an absolutely brilliant job looking at the muscles. So
an honor student?
Third year,
okay.
So she's hoping to go into honours to do a bit more on the hind limb of Genyornis. Yeah, so she's been great and did a lot of the musculature of the wing. And, as that comes out and it's published, there'll be more information on that. But one of the things she found is that you have a kiwi and their wings are about 4 centimetres. The humerus is about 4 centimetres long. So that's
kiwi, the emblematic bird from New Zealand.
Yeah.
Small, and that really long bill as well. And it's flightless.
Yeah. 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 So their humeri, which is like one of the main components of the wing, is about 4 centimetres long. And because it's so short, it's within the body. So it doesn't actually extend past their skin. You can't see it externally.
Okay.
So
the torso swallowed the upper arm.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Yeah. So what Amelia has found that if you look at the length of the genyornis humerus, considering the size of the kiwi and then genyornis being 250 kilos, the humerus is only double the length. So you have a bird that's so many times more massive and yet only double the length of the wing. So if it's articulating with the rest of the pectoral girdle in the bird, then you definitely wouldn't see much of the wing at all outside of the body. So I don't think you'd be able to see them the same way you would in an emu, and definitely nothing like an ostrich or a rhea where they have those long humeri that they can use to run around and display.
Yeah, because they kind of shimmy and they do the shake and stuff.
Yeah,
too.
And use it for steering as they run.
Oh, really?
As well, okay, I didn't know ostriches, that. So.
Very cool. yeah, it's really helping like paint a picture of
very like, vestigial wings. So
yeah, makes sense.
Just very big lumbering things, massive legs.
Do they have, I'm guessing, like a long sort of like snaky gooseneck as well? Or
so no work has actually been done on the verts. We just have a collection, like a vertebral collection, which allows us to estimate the number that they might have. Because in birds, unlike in mammals, where you have the same amount in the neck generally, in birds it changes, so you can have a range.
Classic.
Yeah. Just makes it that much more difficult. So we think that they wouldn't have had a long neck like an emu or a goose. It would have been a bit shorter and stockier. But, yeah, there's a bit more work in that area that needs to be done. So
what got you most excited about working on genyornis? So, like, I guess what was some sort of the big takeaways for your project?
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
I mean, there were a number of things. One of my first projects on birds was on paleognaths, specifically the cassowary. So that's another giant flightless bird from Australia.
Yeah.
It's not anywhere near as big as genyornis, so it's probably... I'm not sure the exact.
Is it the second largest living bird in Australia?
Yeah.
It's got that casque, so that crest on its head, and then like blue skin on its neck.
Yeah, and really colourful like lobes down the front of the neck too.
Yep. And has a reputation for having a kick that can kill people.
Yeah.
No idea if that's...
We have a cassowary specimen and the sternum of it has a hole straight through it.
Oh my gosh.
And it perfectly fits the toe.
Oh.
So they have this massive toe and it's just so sharp and the hole in the sternum just perfectly fits it. And it didn't even die from that.
Oh my gosh.
So... definitely an interesting specimen.
Indestructible kicking birds.
I think so.
Oh, Australia.
they're tough, but they're probably only like 40 to 50 kilos. I'm not 100% sure about that.
Pew! Another quick fact check / size conversion for you. Cassowaries are the third largest bird in the world, and females are slightly larger than males. They can reach up to 175 pounds or 80 kilograms. And male cassowaries normally weigh 121 pounds or 55 kilograms. So Phoebe was pretty close, but yeah, interesting to note that the females are the big mamas and a little bit bigger than the males in cassowaries. Anyway, just wanted to let you know, back to the show.
So yeah, much smaller than dromornithids, but that really got me onto the giant flightless birds. And yeah, everybody loves giant things. And I kind of fell for that as well. Like the idea of having these massive birds that are kind of related to geese, just it blew my mind a little bit to learn about that. So that was what got me into the dromonithids.
I should also ask, like, who are your supervisors for your project?
Trevor Worthy and Mike Lee.
Yep.
A big bird guy and a phylogenetics guy.
Yeah. So I think I chatted to Kayla and Mike Lee was also a supervisor.
Yeah. Yeah. Project. So because he's a phylogenetic specialist, when we have phylogenetics in our project, he'll come on board with that. Although I had a lot less in mind than initially expected. So
yeah. Well, that happens with any PhD. You have these ideas. It's like almost a New Year's resolution.
Yeah.
Just like, I'm going to do all these things. And then as you actually get into it, you're like, might scale this back a bit.
Yeah.
This maybe not doable because of logistics and time. Going to focus on this though. And then depending on what you find, you might be like, oh, this is actually the most interesting thing about this.
Well, that was what happened with the pathologies
So pathologies are like injuries and diseases.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in this, like for any fossils. So
like features on bones that we see that aren't just, you know, normal aspects of the bone.
Yeah.
So things that are caused by breaks or fractures or diseases or infections and anything like that.
Normally, well, depending on what bone it is, they can stick out a bit like a sore thumb. From what I've read, I haven't seen many actual fossils that have paleopaths, but sometimes they get these big, weird growths and the texture goes real gnarly. And then if you have one bone that was fractured and then is in two pieces, and then when it rejoins, sometimes I guess that can get misaligned and stuff too.
So if they're still using the element, then often the bone will misalign. And then when it fuses back together and heals, you get this jagged bone that is just in the wrong shape. But yeah, with all the Geniona stuff, we were seeing exactly that, like a really rugose kind of surface to the bone and lumps and cavities where there shouldn't be. And
if you have multiple specimens as well that you can compare, you get an idea of healthy versus, okay, it's been through the wars.
Yeah. So we had several individuals which I couldn't find any pathologies on. And then we had several individuals which clearly had these fairly severe pathologies, which would have been so painful for them. So, yeah, I can imagine that they really would have been struggling as a population, seeing these pathologies crop up numerous times. And it's the same thing as well. So it indicates that we are seeing more of a population problem rather than just an individual suffering with something.
As you were talking as well, I was thinking, you mentioned before, they're hanging out in pairs. I wonder if they could survive like these injuries and develop these paleopathologies, the bones would then start to heal because they had each other, because they were looking after each other a bit, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, well, potentially we do have some signs of healing. So there's one specimen that we have, which is a sternum, so the chest plate, and it has a hole through it.
Oh, more kicking.
More holes in sternums. Yeah. So
shotguns had not been invented at this point either. No. So that's definitely not on the cards.
Yeah. It's a nice hole. Like, it's really round. And when we scanned it, you can see that the edges of the hole have healed.
Oh.
So the bone has actually enclosed itself, but it's kept this hole through there.
Yep.
So we think that something happened, that got stabbed. They've got really thin chest plates, so it wouldn't have been difficult to go straight through.
Mm.
And then that allowed for some bacteria to get into the sternum itself. So as that infection was developing, the hole would have been healing, but it might have gotten stuck in the mud before it was able to overcome the infection and deal with that. But yeah, it has these big cavities in the bone and all this extra bone growth that shouldn't be there. So I don't really know if it would have been able to survive that if it didn't get stuck in the mud. Who knows? But I can keep my fingers crossed that maybe there were some that didn't have to suffer too much. So
yeah, it is nice that they left their bones behind for us to look at though.
Yes, thank you.
I love it when they're considerate like that. In terms of, I guess, like research that you've done too, is there other things that grab you other than the paleopathologies? Or you mentioned phylo and like working out, I guess, the interrelationships as being an initial seed of an idea at the start, but then...
Yeah, well, initially I was going to make it really large looking at the phylogenetics because...
That's how you get lots of citations too.
Well, the positioning of the dromonithids really calls for a large phylogenetic study.
Oh.
So there's a lot of issues there. But then COVID happened, so I couldn't travel to see the specimens that I needed to do that.
And like then, overseas? Or
yeah.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. And then we found the pathology. So I was like, well, I'll just, I got absolutely carried away with the pathology. So I decided to include that instead. But we're currently publishing a paper on the skull of Genyonis because we finally found a beautiful articulated skull of the bird. And I've been working on that for a few years, and it was recommended that we put in a phylogenetic analysis.
Yeah.
So we just focused on skull morphology and ran those. And basically the analysis told us what we could see from the morphology, all of our analyses that we did already, because the dromanethids are so old that they have this really interesting skull where they have aspects of anseriform morphology, which are your waterfowl, ducks, geese.
Oh, okay.
But they also have aspects of galliform morphology, which are your chickens and quails and turkeys.
Right.
So when these two lineages diverged, the dromanethids would have diverged pretty quickly afterwards before they both got their like characteristic morphologies that they have now.
That we know and love today.
Yeah. So using only extant species is really restrictive because we're looking at species that diverged millions of years ago. So you can say, yes, this is what makes a duck, but 50 million years ago, that is not what made a duck. So we need to keep that in mind and look at how these features evolved and changed over time to see what pathway would have been most likely to get to the dromanethid morphology.
Yeah. So. And I guess then maybe if it could evolve again, given the right set of circumstances, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we still have anhemids alive today in South America. So if they came to Australia or found themselves on an island which allowed for them to get giant and flightless, I wouldn't put it past them. So if they did that, then they would just re-evolve dromanethids, I assume. There'd be some differences, but, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between them already, so.
Any ideas as to what Genyonis ate? Like, you sort of mentioned they're not eating meat, probably vegetarians, but are they browsing? Are they eating like leaves sort of at their height, or maybe they're going for fruits or anything?
Yeah, so there's been a study for dromanethids in general.
Mm.
There was a study that was done by a few people when they were writing a book called Magnificent Meherungs.
Oh, by Murray and Vickers Rich.
Yeah. Yeah, so they travelled around Australia a few times. Well, they travelled around Australia.
Pat's been around Australia a few times.
But they found a few fruiting trees which don't get eaten by anything now. So that indicates that something was eating them at some point and distributing those seeds. And they think the dromanethids contributed to that.
Yeah, right.
But if we're looking at the morphology, it's probably more the Dromornis lineage that was eating fruits.
Okay.
The Genyonis lineage, we find a lot of tiny stones associated with the skeletons. So we can collect them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're gastroliths. Yeah. And because of the preservation, we actually find the sternum and it creates this bowl and all the gastroliths just sit inside this bowl.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we can just scoop them out and we can sort them by size and measure them. But they're all tiny.
Yeah.
They're very small stones. So that indicates to us that they're eating very soft material. So fresh leaves and maybe like small fresh fruits and things, but we haven't found any seeds, so I wouldn't necessarily go for that.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things, though, is that we have aspects of their skull morphology which are suggesting that they're well adapted for having their head submerged in water for some reason. So we're thinking that they probably lived quite close to wetlands and lake edges.
Which then maybe makes them more susceptible to getting bogged when it dries out too.
Yeah. Wow. They would have had to start moving between ephemeral lake systems. And yeah, so they probably were eating very light, delicate leaves and maybe small sticks and things that they just happened to come across. And maybe potentially some soft water plants as well.
Yeah, so just to go back to gastroliths, this is something that modern birds do today as well. Hey, they'll just eat some stones and then it sits in, is it the gizzard?
Yeah.
And it just kind of hangs out there and then like a mortar and pestle, it kind of grinds up stuff mechanically because they don't have teeth.
Yeah.
It's just swallowing, but then that helps them digest.
Yeah, it's a really muscular object. Like if you
a gizzard.
Touch one, it's really solid. So they use all those muscles to move the stones around and then they grind against any of the food that goes through. And it better allows them to process it in the way that cows have multiple stomachs, birds have a gizzard. So.
sometimes like a question that pops up in paleo is like, oh, well, how do you know those rocks just aren't from around? If they're in the bowl of the sternum, that's normally really good. And then are those stones like a little bit different to the stones around the skeleton too?
Yeah. So there aren't really any stones around the skeleton.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that helps.
It's all sand dunes lake beds. It's very muddy and it's all clay as well. So we don't really see any stones there. And the stones themselves are made up of so many different materials that they must have just been collecting these from all over the place. So that suggests that they're probably moving around quite a lot as well to collect all these stones.
Yeah, that's, I think, like another common trend with megafauna stuff is that it wasn't quite land of drought and flooding rains the way Australia is now, but they still would have needed to be on the move if they're hanging out in groups and they're quite big, as the word megafauna suggests, to keep the populations going.
Yeah, so when Genyornis was around, these massive freshwater lake systems that we used to have, they'd have these floods where all of these lakes join up and it just becomes a massive freshwater system. But it was starting to become a lot less often, a lot less regular that that was occurring. So the dromanithids and other megafauna would have been dealing with less reliable water sources and less regular flooding events, which, would have pushed them to distribute more widely as well. But the dromanithids, they describe it really well in Murray and Vickers Rich, where they talk about how the dromanithids are like almost like ballerinas because they've pulled back their toes. So they're quite short and stumpy and their nails as well. So when you think of a typical bird foot, you see those long curved nails at the end.
Yeah.
Dromanithids, it's just short. They're called hooves.
Oh, of course. Perfect for kicking and making circular holes in sternums too.
Yep. They've been tough birds.
That's weird that their feet are so the toes are short and stumpy.
Yeah. So on one toe, they've actually lost a toe bone.
Oh.
So birds are really regular in the number of toe bones that they have in each toe. And then in dromanithids, you just have one less, which is weird.
That's so bizarre.
So what it was described as is that they're kind of converging almost on your hooved ungulates in that they're pulling their toes back. So they're just on like one or two toes. And the dromanithids can't do that because they're restricted as being birds.
Mm.
But they're making their feet kind of as small and solid as possible to probably move long distances between their lake systems.
Oh, my gosh. A giant duck doing its best impersonation of a horse.
Yeah.
So bizarre.
Two-legged horse.
And it's interesting that they kind of did that and there was, I guess, that evolutionary pressure on changing the morphology of the toes and the claws when normally, birds are so, like a bird foot's a bird foot.
Yeah.
That's what I thought before this morning. But then if they have, their toes aren't splayed out as much, then that would also make them more susceptible to getting bogged because if you had wider feet, you have little snowshoes, then you spread that weight out.
Well, interesting, they do actually spread their toes out quite a bit. So if you look
at... Oh, because you'd have tracks as well.
Yeah. So we do have several tracks, some really old ones and some for Genyornis as well. So we can see that their toes might be fairly short and stumpy, but they're spreading them out quite a bit. So they're distributing their weight across
as much
their foot.
As they can.
Yeah. That would have helped a bit. Yeah, I think to live in these environments, which are pretty wet.
Yeah.
So they would have had to be able to deal with that to some extent. And then move through these quite arid areas as well to get to the next environment.
Yeah.
So we're seeing these differences between the skull and the hind limbs almost, which makes them really weird birds.
And then also just two extremes. Like,
from wetland environments to very dry desert environments, I suppose. But, I mean, that's why they were so...
Long-lived.
Long-lived, I assume, and... Yeah.
And by long-lived, we're kind of referring to the fossil record and the extent
the family
of that.
rather than individuals.
Yeah.
Although they probably were very long-lived as well.
Yep.
So Genyornis would have taken 2 years to reach sexual maturity and then several more to become skeletally mature.
Yeah, right.
Whereas other relatives of Genyornis, so Dromornis, probably took about 7-ish years to reach sexual maturity.
Wow, okay.
So they would have been juveniles for a really long time.
Yep.
And running about with really long lives and not worrying about anything. And by the time Dromornis was 500 kilos, it would have been way too big to be hunted by many of Australia's carnivores. So they probably didn't need to worry about that too much, aside from crocodiles.
Yeah, yeah. There were some pretty gnarly crocs getting around at that time and stuff. But yeah, it's always a bonus when, say, I don't know, you're big enough that an eagle can't pick you up and drop you.
Yes, so. Especially when we keep finding that there's more and more very large eagles. But I assume you'll talk to Ellen Mather at some point about that.
That's on the cards, yeah, and vultures. I'm very excited. But yeah, like, it's awesome to get more insight about these giant birds. Yeah, you mentioned before we don't really know much about juveniles or eggs, but then to work out the lifespan of individuals, does that mean there's been like bone histology done?
Yes. Yeah. So Anyosia Chintamitran from South Africa, I think she's at Cape Town, she came and sampled Dromornis and Genyornis specimens and took them back and analysed them. So you can see the structure of the bone. There's indications of growth cycles. And from that, you can see how long it would have taken them to reach sexual and skeletal maturity. So
yeah. So, yeah, tree ring kind of principle. Yeah. Saw into the bone and count the rings.
Such an odd idea for animals. But
yeah, it works.
It works.
And then, yeah, the seasonality as well. You'd see like a little doots of a ring and then all of a sudden like a big ring when there's a good season. Yeah, that's awesome.
So you can see when they've grown a lot versus when they haven't.
Okay, let's try and open a can of worms because this never goes well with any of the guests that I have. Let's talk taxonomy and phylogenetics. Is it a bit of a mess? Because I think my perception from the outside is that maybe the interrelationships of the Australian stuff is maybe a bit better known than maybe where that group then sits relative to everything else. Is that complete garbage or?
It's almost the other way around.
Ah, okay.
So in both respects, there's been challenges. Okay. But one of the problems with the relationships of the individual species and the different genera in the Dromornithidae is that they don't always have comparable elements. So
classic fossil problem.
Yeah, exactly. So we have these genera and that's great and they're able to be distinguished based off of these certain features. But then, you know, we think that Genyornis is most closely related to the Ilbandornis lineage. But we only now have comparable elements of the skull for Genyornis. And with Ilbandornis, there's still only a partial mandible and a cranium. So we don't have the upper beak, which would be a really significant part for understanding how closely related they are. They're distributed temporally as well in time. So Ilbandornis is known from the late Miocene, whereas we have Genyornis in the Pleistocene and there's no proper record. There's like potential Pliocene ones, but
oh, are they just like a bit hard to interpret and no one's really sure? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So we have this massive temporal span of these animals, but it's really just fossils dotted around the place that we can allocate to species, but we can't really build a family tree as such.
So with holotype specimens of Genyornis and other related species, what tends to be the holotype? Is it just whatever they have at the time?
Well, the first Dromornithid was only known from a femur.
Oh,
so that's our Pliocene Dromornithid, Dromornis australis. And there's never been anything else found of it that has been recorded. So we don't really know a lot about that one. So every other Dromornithid has been named off of a femur, aside from one Ilbandornis species, which they didn't have a femur for. So Trevor Worthy and Adam Yates had to come along and sort of re-describe the Ilbandornis species so that we could actually figure out which one was which and how to associate other elements with these individual species.
Yeah.
So they clarified that, which was great, but then
sounds
everything
like hard work.
Yeah, yeah. Everything else has been named off of femora.
Okay.
So thankfully, it's been mostly consistent.
Yeah. It is easiest to try and compare fossils when you have apples and apples, not apples and oranges.
It was definitely challenging for them, I think, to make sure they had a good enough sample as well, because Dromornithids are sexually dimorphic.
Hey, it's Adele just editing the episode. I was listening back to this part and realized that we don't really explain what sexual dimorphism is, so I just wanted to pop this in here. Sexual dimorphism is when there's like two distinct body types within a species. So it can be differences in colors. Think the peacock and the peahen, where the female is like more natural tones, greens and browns, but the male is that brilliant blue, and then the big tail feathers too. And it can also be size differences in body shape. Anyway, hope that helps. Back to the episode.
Which one's the bigger one?
Males.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, typically.
And how big is the size difference, actually?
It's not like actually,
noticeable?
Yeah. Okay. It's noticeable.
So you can eyeball it. And, okay.
It varies in the extent. Of course, you have some like overlap as well between the two. So you like have larger females and
like
smaller
males. Like in humans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there are some pretty clear trends that we do have the sexual size dimorphism between the two groups.
Yeah.
But that makes it hard because you might have a large bone and a much smaller bone. It could be a very large male and a very small female. So you don't know if that's species or individual difference.
Yeah. My personal thing is I don't like when people name new species just based on the fact that it's big.
Yeah.
And then I guess another way of combating that is you could make scans and 3D models of those bones and then scale them up so that the same size, same scale.
Yeah.
And then if you're comparing like a bump somewhere, you could see, okay, is it a one for one or is it actually genuinely different?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, it's okay to say, you know, this species is smaller, but you also, like, it's good if you can have other features that support that, because then, you know, when you do see this size fluctuation, you can still identify it to that species, regardless of whether it's a large one or a small one. So,
I don't think I asked this before. In Genyornis, is there just one species in the genus or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's some Genyornis, but which is just potential Genyornis specimens.
Yeah.
But they're very underrepresented. It's questionable. I haven't actually seen a lot of that material, so I haven't been able to go and confirm if it is Genyornis.
Yep.
It's just that it's been a dromanithid from a Pleistocene locality. So that's about it.
And then for the stuff that you looked at, was it mostly based in South Australia, or did you have to also go to like other museums across Australia to look for your group?
No, so it's mainly in South Australia.
Okay. Well, that would have been good for COVID too.
Yeah. So I was really lucky in that.
Did you ever get fossils online and have them in your house?
No, not in my house.
Okay. Well, no, I've done that before, but like that was with Age of Dinosaurs and they've known me for a while. So
that's,
when I was naming Ferro Draco, I had it in our house for a few
months. That would have been really
months.
Distracting.
It was also good though. I mean, it's one part of me was just always terrified for the safety of the specimen. Because I'm like, oh, if there's a fire, remember, you've got the fossil and grab it on your way out of the house.
Take that first.
But other than that, it really took the pressure off as opposed to doing like a museum research visit and then just trying to blitz through stuff. And it's like, okay, I'm going to do all these photos and I'm going to do observations and I'm maybe going to scan stuff. Like it can be a lot.
Yeah. So I was really lucky in that I actually only had to do two visits to museum, and that was the South Australian Museum in South Australia. So that was really easy for me. Most of that's because I'm predominantly working on skull material, which we've found during Flinders University expeditions to Lake Calabona over the past couple of years. And they've been prepped and they're technically, most of them are South Australian Museum specimens, but we haven't handed them over to the museum yet. So they're in storage at Flinders University for me to access. And where was I going with this?
I don't know, but I now have a question.
Yeah.
Lake Calabona, like what's the field work been like?
It's
quite hot and dry, isn't
it? It's very rural. So we're a couple of hours drive from the nearest station.
Oh, which, like sheep station or something.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
So Lake Calabona itself is a fossil reserve. So there's no sheep or cows on that, but it's surrounded by stations.
Yep.
So we'd drive to this station and then Lake Calabona is a couple of hours drive from that. You can't drive onto the lake because you'd get bogged.
Yep.
So we camp further away in a nice treed area, one of the very few treed areas.
Scrappy she oaks.
Yeah.
As
a couple
Kayla
of
put
eucalypts
it.
And that's about it.
Slim pickings.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. But we get to go on little buggies and quads onto the lake, which is so fun. And we've had helicopters out there as well, which has been exciting.
Yep.
And basically we just lie in the sand and dig through very thick mud for 3 weeks.
How do you pick like a site, or you've, I mean, obviously you've done some digs out there before. Are there layers in particular that you try and hit, or?
So Trevor Worthy and Aaron Caymans, who've been out there a lot more often, they've scoped out a lot of Lake Calabona, and it's pretty flat. The fossils that we're seeing are coming out at mostly the same kind of layer.
You would see them eroding
from the surface. Ooh. Yeah. So you can see
them. A drone would be great for that.
Yes. Yeah. So we can actually see them on the surface.
Awesome.
And it looks super frassy because it's just salt and sand. So it's really destroying the fossils very rapidly as there's any wind, and you get lots of sandstorms out there. But then the second you go beneath the couple of centimetres of sand layer on top, it's just perfect bone in mud. And we brush all that away. If it's really important material, then we'll try and solidify the frass using paraloid, which is a thermoplastic resin.
Plastic beads dissolved in acetone. The good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, man, if we didn't have that. Like when they first went to Calabona, they didn't have that. And they were on Camelback. So I have no idea how they managed to get anything back to the museum, to be honest. And they were dealing with rabbit plagues as well. Sicknesses from that. I love these old publications because they'll publish the stories in there from their fieldwork as well.
Things that we normally keep to ourselves these days.
They're just like, no, we'll publish that. And yeah, they talk about the rabbit plagues and everything. And man, it sounded rough.
Just to circle back to paraloid, so the way it works, I don't think I've ever mentioned this on the podcast, is that you put it on the fossil, the acetone evaporates, but then the plastic kind of binds things together. So if you've got like really thin connective struts called trabeculae, it'll kind of bind them together. If there's maybe like cracks and stuff, it'll just fill in the gaps essentially.
Yeah. So we have to melt it. We make it quite thin, so that it can go through all the layers of bone and get into the middle.
Yeah.
Because
if you don't make it right, it just sits on top and it's like, oh no, that was actually too strong. So
And then the bone will just break anyway. So
it hasn't done its job. So kind of just soaks it up. And then I know with Ada dinosaurs, if it just soaks it up really quickly, we just say it's really thirsty and just like give it another drink.
Keep giving it more to drink. Yep. Until it dries out and you have this bone that is really solid and we can...
So you don't plaster it at all?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah. So because we maintain all of the associations of the elements...
Yeah, that'd be super important.
They didn't used to. They separated all of the genuina specimens by type. So they put all the femora together.
And they
lost all of the individual information.
Oh, no.
So what we do now is we don't necessarily pull out the individual bones... We'll find the good bones that we want because there's so many out there. We can be really selective.
Oh, that's why you asked me the other night, do we collect everything?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Makes sense.
Yeah, we don't have a big team, so we need to be selective to pull out the right things.
Yeah.
So we will pour heaps of the resin into the bone that we can see.
Yeah.
And then we cut around that and plaster that because the...
So you bring the rock with you.
Yeah, well, it's in this clay.
Does the clay dry out once you start digging into it too?
Yeah, it does. So it's this really beautiful, like rich blue, and then it dries out and it just goes grey.
Yeah.
But what also happens because it's so salty is that all the salt will leach out. So the paraloid that we use helps keep the salt in the bone.
Oh.
So it stops it from leaving, which would crack the bone. And when we pull the casts out, we wrap that in plastic so that it doesn't...
It's
evaporate.
A closed system, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
It maintains the water in the clay, which stop all the salt from leaching out.
Yeah.
Because otherwise the bones will just be destroyed.
Okay.
So we have a very good process now that our preparator, Kerry Burke, has been working on to make sure we can get these from the field to the lab and prepped in a way that protects the bones and has them as beautiful as possible at the end.
Yeah. The goal of fieldwork is not to... just completely dig out a bone in the field. It's actually to recover it and get it to the lab safe in one piece so that then you can do that meticulous work in a nice controlled environment where like a sandstorm isn't going to just come and rip through stuff.
And it's a lot of work when you're using this paraloid, which works as a glue, and you do have it on the surface and then the sandstorm comes along and all of a sudden you have this thick layer of sand just glued to your bone. You're like, that was so beautiful.
Everywhere you do field work, it's different. And even though you can have weeks of experience, each scenario is just a little bit different.
Yeah. We get these gypsum crystals out there that are just massive on the surface. These huge things.
Like bowling ball?
Yeah, like big. They go from really small crystals, like just tiny, thin strips of crystal, to these massive things that you can pick up and just hold. And it's just a really intense region to be in.
Well, I guess that's good in a way, because not every man and his dog has gone down there to collect fossils themselves. But in saying that, when you were describing the fossils eroding out and just how destructive it is, I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah. It's hard because, like, we went a couple of weeks ago and we were just there to work with the ABC on a documentary that they're doing.
Oh, yeah. Did they tease some stuff or is that unrelated? No, hang on.
Possibly. I don't know.
I'm getting really confused. There's been a lot of paleo news out this month, which I'm super happy for, but there's been at
least... Trying to keep up.
I think there's been like 3 stories every week. It's been nuts.
Yeah, there's been heaps. Oh, it's so good seeing it be so productive, paleontology in general. But yeah, so we were out there. We had 2 days to excavate, whereas normally we have about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So we really had to pick exactly what we wanted. And Aaron Caymans flew in first and... He just has the eye for fossils. So he was like, yeah, we'll go to this part of Calabona. And everything we wanted was right there.
Oh, that's good. But that's what you want for a media team, because we've had some out on our digs as well. And we can't promise our participants that we'll find stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when you've got a film crew and they want to film you digging around
You're
something.
You're always a bit nervous that it won't be there.
Yeah, exactly right. And then it's just like, how am I going to make a story out of this?
Yeah. Yeah, so we were really lucky in that sense and we found everything that we wanted. But we were digging up a genionis and we selected one leg that we were going to collect because it has a concretion which forms around the bone when the soft tissue disintegrates. So when I don't know exactly what it is, but what's wonderful about it is that it can preserve soft tissue. So we get impressions of the skin and the feathers of these
what
animals.
What are they like?
The feathers are just, they're very thick in the shaft.
Okay.
But they're basically, aside from that, they're quite a lot like an emu feather.
Yeah,
so very simple.
Yeah.
What you'd expect for a bird that hasn't needed flight feathers for millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so we can see these and they're in the concretion.
So it's just the like impression of the feather. It's not the feather itself.
No.
Yeah, so we can't see colour.
No, unfortunately not.
Yep.
It would have been
just
nice.
Just thought I'd clarify.
But, yeah, there's always that hope that we might find something. Yeah, I think with all the salt and water, it would just destroy anything else. So.
And then do they have scaly feet?
Yeah, so interestingly, they do. So that's one of my next projects I'm going to be working on is publishing some of this soft tissue stuff for genionis. This foot that we found is all, it's gone straight down into the mud and the toes have kind of curled up in there. So we have this concretion around the foot and we've pulled all of that out because we want to preserve as much of that as possible for all of the soft tissue information. But it meant that we left the other foot behind and it probably completely disintegrated within a week. So it would have been gone very quickly, despite the fact that when we found it, it was perfectly preserved. So it happens very quickly at Calabona, like how fast you lose these fossils.
Yeah.
So if you're out there 1 year, you might find, I think I found like 450 diprotodons in this region.
Whoa.
So we can only excavate so many, but we'll find more. And then the next time you go back, all of them will pretty much be gone. And
that sounds super challenging.
Yeah. But there'll be more erosion.
Yeah. But you still can't earmark and be like, next year I'll come back to this. Because we do that with our sites pretty frequently.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just not an option.
If you don't grab it, then it's just gone. Probably not going to be there. So.
Wow. How many times have you been out doing field work and stuff?
I've only been out to Calabona twice.
Well, it's still like 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's a lot of time that we've spent out there because, you know, you spend 2 days driving there and it takes so much work and effort to build a trip like that. That you really want to make the most of it and get as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's other fossil localities that I've been to as well. So Alcoota, which is really different.
That's in Australia as well.
Yeah, so Alcoota is in the Northern Territory and it's a very dense like fossil accumulation. So it's just thick layers of fossils.
So like a cave?
No, it's just out in the desert on the ground. We camp very close by, so it's really nice.
Sounds good when you don't have to wake up that early to go to work.
Yeah. You can just wander out of your campsite and there you are right with the fossils. And it's just this floor of fossils. So again, you can't collect everything because they're all overlapping, and you might find something that is really unique and special, so you have to prioritize that, and you might have to remove or accidentally go through something that you already have a few of.
Yeah.
Because it's just so dense. And then a place like Pimper as well, which is another fossil locality much closer to Lake Calabona, but a lot older. And you're doing a lot of walking around. You find lots of small things on the surface and some things buried as well. But yeah, the environment is really different again. So
saltier or not?
Yeah,
salty?
Well, it's still on salt lakes.
Yeah.
But just because of the time that you're dealing with, like, the geology is quite different.
Okay.
So it's interesting experiencing these different places around Australia, and like the Narracourt Caves, again, they're caves. So you're doing a lot of crawling and things to get to it. And it's just such a diversity of places.
Yeah.
And every time you have to learn a new way of dealing with whatever the fossils are in. And
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I've not experienced like any megafauna digs. Like, maybe I'll get there one day. But yeah, I've done digs in the outback with like big, heavy farm machinery. And then I've done digging with Dinosaur Dreaming, which is on the beach.
Yeah.
And permits. And you have to do basically everything by hand. And the rock is as hard as concrete. So like, just there's 10 or so million years separating those localities. In some cases, more like 20 million years. But like, they just could not be more different. Even though they're both like dinosaur deposits. So
Yeah, it's amazing how you have to adjust for the location and everything. It's definitely not easy. And the work that the preparators do to deal with all the different materials that we just bring back from the field, like, good luck with this.
It's your problem now.
But no, it's actually so much fun prepping out the material.
You enjoy
the
prepping?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's a really almost meditative, therapeutic kind of process, seeing the fossils come out. Because you see it in the field and it's very exciting, but you don't get to see all of the fossil and it doesn't look as beautiful because you have to just wrap it up and get it back to protect it. But in the lab, you can move really slowly and make the most of it and get a really good result.
I like sorting. Personally, I really don't like prepping that much because I'm just in my head too much and I'm just going like, is that bone? Is that bone? Is that bone? Is that bone? Like, on a loop constantly. I'm a bit more chilled these days, but I'm still very like...
Yeah.
Depending on like...
Nervous.
Yeah. And it's just like, well, this might be really important and this might be the only one of this kind ever in the world and I'm responsible for it. Oh, no. So, yeah.
Sits on your shoulders a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Whereas I'm the opposite. I did a lot of sorting first with Lisa Nenk, who works on a number of different Pleistocene sites across southern Australia. And they're all very small fossils.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I really like big things. So I moved to dromanithids, which are massive. But I've been forced to deal with smaller things because all their relatives are so much smaller. Like quails, they're tiny.
Yeah.
So I have to deal on both sides of the spectrum. Well, I mean, not quite as big as some of the dinosaurs, of course, but... You know, we have the dromanithids, which are really large compared to quails, and just being able to deal with both sizes. Whereas I think I got quite comfortable working with large bones that I got really nervous moving into sorting because it's a lot of smaller stuff.
And then depending on how you're sorting, if you grab something with tweezers, sometimes you just fumble it and then it just goes pew across the room. And then you're in an office chair and you're like, okay, let me just check directly underneath me before I can roll
very
to actually look for
move
it.
Back.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have had that experience.
Yeah.
A little bit. I've avoided asking this question. I'm sure you're getting it all the time and you don't have to answer it, but are you going to keep working on Jenny Ornis or, like, what are next steps?
I would absolutely love to keep working on Jenny Ornis. There's
manifest.
Yeah, so there's still a few things that I have in the works. So I've modelled the dromanithid inner ears and I've been looking at shape variation for them. And that's going to be something that I do present on at KVEPS. Oh. It's not published yet. So there's some really exciting information coming from that because dromanithids are just so weird.
Well, like, and flightless birds as well, because like you sort of touched on at the start, their ancestors were flighted. So their inner ear is geared up, ready to do, you know, some really different stuff and deal with really a three-dimensional space. Whereas something that's walking around on the ground, lumbering about, probably isn't living life in the fast lane, probably doesn't have to deal with
that
so much information coming in so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're really seeing that change in the dromaenopod ears. They're very different to what we expected. Okay. So what
did you think they would be like walking in?
Well, if you look at paleognaths, the ratites, which are giant flightless paleognaths, they have inner ears that don't look that different to other birds.
Oh.
So
like emus and cassowaries,
yeah,
their inner ears.
Surprisingly, there's not a lot of variation.
Okay.
But
that's a wild card.
Yeah, when you look at dromaenopods, variation. So it's very hard to identify specific aspects which are causing these changes, because when you think about flightlessness, there's so many other things that come with that. It could be, you know, that they're running, so they still need that fast-paced recognition of changes in the environment.
Tree.
Yeah, but they could be slow-paced walkers, and then they got big as well, so the size would potentially have an effect. And the dromaenopods, their heads got really big too, whereas in paleognaths, their heads stayed really small.
Yeah.
So that would have an effect.
Yeah.
So trying to isolate what the cause is of this change is really challenging.
And there's so many factors that are probably all working together,
exactly,
as biology does.
And because we know that the dromaenopods were likely giant and flightless in the early Eocene, that means that we have millions of years of them evolving in this state, which probably contributed to us seeing more extreme adaptations to this flightless lifestyle than you see in the emus and cassowaries, which are a bit younger relatively. So like maybe emus and cassowaries just haven't been...
Yeah, maybe they'll get there.
They're long enough, yeah.
Yeah.
They just need a couple more million years before they start to have these modifications as well that we're seeing in the dromaenopods. But then it could be something else. So, yeah, that's been a challenge.
And then to study the inner ear, I'm guessing you're not cutting into the skull and looking at it in person.
No,
you're doing
thankfully
it from
not.
X-ray, CT scans and that kind of thing to...
Yeah, so we've scanned the dromaenopod skulls, and I have scans of a number of their relatives, so galloanthers, chickens, ducks, geese, things like that, and also the other flightless birds, large flightless birds, and then some extra more distant relatives as well.
Yeah. Do you get this stuff scanned at like the synchrotron or anything, or like at a hospital?
So we did get the Genyornis skull scanned. I think we neutron scanned it.
Oh, yeah. So that would be over in Sydney.
At ANSTO with Joseph Bevett. He was really
legend.
Helpful. Yeah,
oh,
absolute legend. He did a lot of work in it. Unfortunately, didn't work. The problem with Calabona is that the skulls have filled up with this concretion and the density of it is exactly the same as the bone. So unless you have a natural break of the concretion from the bone itself, it's very difficult to take out the concretion and see those scans.
The density difference between the things, it's not working.
Yeah, yep. So that had a lot of challenges. So we actually re-scanned the Genyornis skull in a micro CT scanner that they have at Flinders University.
Oh, swish.
And I know, right? It's pretty new.
It's great when unis have like their own scanners and stuff.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, they're not getting used.
Yeah. And it has a really large space in it because it was initially built for work looking at how knee implants take pressure. And we're like,
that's
well,
so niche.
We can just put paleo, like,
you can just put
paleo.
Bones in there,
Yeah, exactly. It's bones.
Yeah.
Kind of the same thing. But yeah, so we pinpointed the ear and just scanned that one area so that we could get super high resolution for just the ear region.
Yeah.
And that actually worked really well because it is a bit protected, so it wasn't filled in as much
with
all of this extra concretion. So thankfully, we managed to pull that out and it worked quite well. But the other dromaenopod scans, I think one was synchrotron scanned at ANSTO as well, and we've had CT and micro CT and, so a variety of things.
Well, Joseph is tinkering constantly. So I wouldn't be surprised if like a few months down the track, he's just like, hey, I worked out how to streamline this. Send me more stuff again. I want to have another crack at it because it's not like he's reinventing himself, but he's really keen on trying to streamline the process as much as possible, which is great because it's maximizing scan time for everyone, not just paleos. So
yeah, and it was amazing because you have these people who specialized in a method, which would be scanning in this respect, but a lot of these things are built for the medical industry. So they don't think that as paleos we'd come along, and they probably never thought that they'd be scanning bones of these animals that went extinct a long time ago. And here we are, like, utilizing these medical products to do this work, which is wonderful. And it's the same with the programs that we use to then model the skulls or the bones out of the surrounding matrix, which at Flinders we predominantly use MIMX.
Yep.
Which is a medical imaging program as well.
I never knew that.
So,
okay.
But because so many paleontologists have been using it, it's actually started to be modified a little bit more to expand into different industries because we're taking over. Yeah, we need all these things. And like, oh, well, we didn't think about that because we were just so focused on humans.
Yeah, just on that note as well, I know someone who did modeling of how sauropods walk, and she basically stole, she didn't steal. She, what's the word I want? Anyway, she used programs from biomed and engineering as well. So the sauropods have column-like limbs. There's a lot of weight just sort of going down in one plane straight down.
Yeah.
So trying to like work out how much weight they could cope with in that direction, but then also how they moved and stuff using, yeah, these programs that were not made for us, but we co-opted. That's the word
exactly,
I was thinking
co-opted.
Of. That's much nicer.
Rather than stolen.
Oh, this is going to be hard trying to be professional at a conference for the next week, but I'm going to try. Anyway.
But I think that's the thing with paleo. We're really expanding
we're
so much.
We're scrappy as well.
Yeah.
Like,
but nothing gets made for paleo specifically. Like, we don't have the funding to put thousands of dollars into building a program for us to use micro CT scans. We utilize what's there and we turn that into something that we can really make the most of.
Yeah, same with field work, like just being scrappy and just trying to make the best out of what you have available as well. A friend of mine has seen me photograph fossils and he's like, wow, I didn't realize your setup was so ghetto, because I'll have like a random piece of cardboard as a reflector. I'll have blue tack underneath the fossil, but like there's a layer of fabric separating it as well to try and hold it in place. And just
a picture and it just rolls.
Oh my gosh. The amount of times I've yelled at tiny fossils where I'm just like, it's held still for 10 seconds, 1 second before it's ready to like open the exposure. It's just like, I'm like, no. I once also took a photograph of a big sauropod chloron. I just stuffed it in a mug, like a big sturdy mug with the fabric, because I needed proximal view.
Yeah.
And I didn't have like a tube or anything. I'm just like the big,
what do
the
I
big
have
mug.
On
yeah. yeah. Went to the tea room. So we'll have one final circle back to family groupings.
Yeah. Got a bit distracted.
yeah. It's so good. Okay. So big, broad interrelationships.
Yeah. So they were initially thought to be paleognaths, of course, closely related to the emu and cassowary because they're giant, flightless, and in Australia. So
yeah.
Perfect assumption.
Occam's razor, simplest explanation.
Exactly. Parsimonious ideas. So we, it was actually done quite a while ago when they finally found some skulls of dromaeothids and realized that they have very characteristic features of the Galloanserae radiation. So instead of being closely related to these birds, which are giant and flightless now, they're actually in the radiation that holds the galliforms with your chickens and quails and the anseriforms, your ducks and geese. And early analyses of their morphology suggested that they were most closely related to some anseriforms. However, when they were placed in a phylogenetic analysis, a more extensive phylogenetic analysis, they instead came out as sister to the gastornithiforms as an ordinal level relationship next to the galliforms. However, we've been looking at the skull of Genyonis and completely reviewing all of the skull morphology and myology for this group.
What is myology?
The musculature.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
My dumb brain, it's getting towards lunchtime and my focus is getting worse. And my dumb brain was just like, you know the word for mycology and that's mushrooms. No, she doesn't mean that. Just ask.
Dromaeothid mushrooms, you know. So we have been looking a bit more in depth at that. And because that's such an old radiation and like they have aspects of both galliforms and anseriforms, we really had to clarify what was happening to this morphology back when they first diverged, like just before the end of the Cretaceous period. So,
oh, that's a really long time.
A really long time back. But really what it seems is that they have a lot of aspects which are forced into convergence with the gastrolithiforms just because of large size. But then a large number of aspects which appear to be more phylogenetically significant, so more indicative of their phylogenetic relationships to other groups.
Yeah, stuff they've retained from their ancestors as opposed to stuff they've gotten later because of how they're living.
Yeah, but also other derived features which are from the early radiation of the group that they're in.
So just to make things easy for just you.
It's a real mosaic of a skull, you know?
Yep.
But they definitely have enough features which quite closely align them with the anhemids in South America. So we think we can pretty confidently now say that they are very early anseriforms. But because they're very early, they have retained some galliform morphologies. But people think that the original bird, or like the bird that first evolved and led to the other radiations and made it through the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary, was very chicken-like. So
something about a chicken running around. I know, like,
why does it have to be a chicken?
Like that one in Moana.
Yeah. Yeah. Just imagine that. Running around some dinosaur legs.
Yeah, the world's ending. It's just this chicken.
Yeah.
That's just like,
I'm fine. So that would have been the more plesiomorphic form or the ancestral form for this group.
Yeah.
So rather than the dromanithids having features that are galliform, which is what it looks like now, they actually have features which are ancestral, but they're only retained in the galliforms and not the anseriforms.
Ah, okay. Some of them have like niched down and become something that we now recognize as that thing, but then some are more, I don't know, OG.
So it's been a bit of a mess, and it ended up taking about 50,000 words to sort all of this out. Luckily, thank goodness, there's been some amazing work done by people globally on anseriform and galliform fossil representatives from a long time ago. So we can really utilize that work to clarify these kind of evolutionary processes and changes.
Yeah, we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yep.
Thank goodness. It's scary to think about trying to do all like this on your own. And like doing a PhD, as you know, is like, well, you've got your lab and your partner as well.
Yeah.
But it can be such like a solo endeavor.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes on, and especially with the dromanithids, I was learning all about them. I was like, there's just things that don't make sense to me, and I just couldn't wrap my head around it. And I ended up having to pull in Jacob Blockland because he knew a lot about skull musculature. And he was the one that was really like, you know, for the dromanithids, we actually had to look at what the muscles were doing to then interpret these osseous structures, because in some cases what we're seeing isn't the bone itself. It's part of a muscle that's ossified, which then looks like the bone. So there's been a lot of reinterpretations on what parts are.
Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah, it's been a whirlwind of research. And after all of that, I'm still like, I love it for some reason.
Well, yeah, normally that's a good sign. And
yeah,
it's good to hear that you're super passionate about what you do and obviously super knowledgeable.
It's also been very fun. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Again, we've taken up a fair amount of your time. Let me buy you some lunch. Before we go, though, like, where can people find you, or is there anything that you wanted to direct people to?
So I basically live at Flinders.
Okay.
So if you ever want to come to Flinders Lab and have a look, then, you know, sometimes we can work in to have people come and see the fossils. We've got...
You would have open days as well, like... When
and we have loads of fossils on display as well. We have big windows that people can see, so they can come and see some fossils and get in touch. I'm on Twitter. I predominantly talk to people through that. So at Phoebe Ornis is
a good way
to get in contact with
me. I love when people make portmanteaus of like their name and then the stuff they work on.
Yeah.
Big fan of that.
It took me a while to think about this. Once I did, I was like, yes, it's that one.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show and taking time.
Thanks heaps to Phoebe for sitting down and chatting with me about her PhD work on Genyonis. As predicted, she gave a great presentation at CAVAPS. Honestly, across the board, the standard of the posters and the presentations was absolutely mind-blowing. And I'm just so grateful that I got to chat with Phoebe and everyone else while the conference was on. And I can't wait to bring you more episodes recorded during my time in NAM in Melbourne. Before we wrap up with final thank yous, I wanted to let you know where you can find Genyonis IRL and talk about some of the pop culture things inspired by this incredible animal. Off the top of my head, you can see a replica mount of Genyonis at Melbourne Museum. It's next to a Diprotodon skeleton. And again, Diprotodon is the largest marsupial to ever live. Technically, I think it's in the section known as the Dinosaur Walk, but they've managed to sneak in some megafauna near the end. They're sort of in between the dinosaurs and the Triceratops exhibit, so keep an eye out for them. At the National Dinosaur Museum in Canberra, there's definitely a mural with a giant flightless bird. Actually, in fact, there's two birds together, so it could well be Genyonis, but I can't remember if there was a skeleton associated with them or not. But as always, if you know where else you can see examples of this fossil, hit me up on Instagram at palsinpaleo and I'll do a little update in a future episode. In terms of merch, Genyonis was included in the 2008 Australia Post stamp series celebrating Australian megafauna. Back in the day when stamps cost just 55 cents. The artwork for the AusPost 2008 stamp series was painted by none other than Dr. Peter Trussler, a legend in our field, essentially a national treasure at this point, who I've mentioned on the podcast a bunch of times. And I actually have a digitally printed canvas of the full megafauna painting that he did. Peter sent it to me, and it's possibly one of my favorite artistic reconstructions of Genyonis. Oftentimes, they can kind of look derpy and, I don't know, like off balance, but Peter really makes this amazing animal look poised and dignified. And Peter also did the cover art for the book Magnificent Mihirungs, The Colossal Flightless Birds of the Australian Dreamtime by Murray and Vickers Rich, which Phoebe mentioned during our chat. So I should have mentioned this before. Dromornithids are also known as mihirungs, and that's based on mihirung parangmal, a term used by the Djaburong people of Western Victoria, which means giant bird. So if you see that term thrown around, that's what it means and where it comes from. In 2014, the Perth Mint released a coin made of pure silver featuring Genyonis. So if you love both fossils and coin collecting, definitely keep an eye out for that and maybe add it to your collection. And my personal favorite piece of merch, Lost Watering Hole, aka the Lancefield Brewery, have a draft beer called Flightless, inspired by Genyonis. Lancefield, by the way, is a famous fossil site that has produced loads of megafauna fossils in what's now known as the Lancefield Swamp. Not just Genyonis, but fossil kangaroos, Diprotodon, and Zygomaturus, which you'll hear about in an upcoming episode. By the way, if anyone's tried any of these beers from Lancefield Brewery and wants to let me know what they thought, please message me. I'd love to share your thoughts on the podcast. That's it for pop culture, and that brings us to final thank yous. If you love this episode, it'd mean a lot if you could leave a review and rate the podcast in Apple Podcasts. For whatever reason, that's the be-all and end-all for podcast ratings, and we talk about really cool but underrated fossils, so the more we can connect with paleo people and get that information out there, the better. This episode was recorded with assistance from the Conservation Department at Museums Victoria. Shoutouts to Lizzie and Richard for allowing Pals and Paleo to record in that space and enabling access to back of house. Our theme song is by Hello Kelly, a Canadian-based band that describe themselves as the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles of pop rock. They're currently on hiatus, but if you're keen for fresh tunes with a similar vibe, the lead singer of Hello Kelly, Francie, has released some solo stuff on Spotify. Just search for Francie Planet and that'll pop up. Big thanks to Francie for also editing the show and working with me to bring this thing to life. Pals and Paleo would not sound as sweet without his support and guidance. Our podcast cover art was made by Crumpet Clubhouse, specifically Jenny Zhao, which really helped me clarify the tone and energy I wanted to bring to you with the podcast. So if you're looking for help with branding, highly recommend working with them. Finally, I want to thank you for listening. Thank you so much for spending so much time with me. I hope listening to this super lengthy episode was worth it and that you learned something. As always, Pals and Paleo will be back soon with fresh facts on old fossils, but until next time, look after yourself and just keep digging.